Welcome to the Freshman 15, a film discussion podcast where we focus on the freshman works of 15 notable directors.
Here's what we do each episode. We talk about a different freshman film, what's good, what's bad, what themes and stylistics the director went on to use in later films, and what was kicked to the curb.
Also, we'll give you our opinion on whether the film still stands up, if it ever did, or if it's for completists only.
I'm Daniel Long, and one time in high school, there was a girl I had a crush on. I think she had a crush on me, and in a sweet moment of her wanting to take care of me, she zipped up my jacket, but then also zipped up my lip in the jacket.
And I'm Jeremy Bear, and I'd like to tell you a little bit more about myself, but if I do, I would probably just whisper it in your ear so that no one could ever know what I'm saying. Anyhow, Daniel, welcome back. We had a little bit of a break from our regular episodes.
I know. I mean, holidays, right?
Yeah, it's been a while, and it's been a full month since our last regular episode. As of course, I'm sure you recall, our last full episode was our Paul Thomas Anderson episode.
Yeah, and, you know, we got some good responses for that episode.
We did. In fact, if you wouldn't mind, Daniel, I'd like to read a couple of the responses that we received.
Yeah, and I think this is one of my favorite parts of this whole thing. I'm grateful for it.
It's the point of the whole thing, in a way. So, yes, we do appreciate it. So we received an email from a woman named Nima, and I apologize, Nima, if I'm mispronouncing your name. But Nima, who shares that she's from the Middle East. So, of course, we're thrilled that our podcast is reaching around the world, commenting to us about the Paul Thomas Anderson episode. She says, well, there was this part that you guys said that you think we can't see the I love you as my own son kind of scene in the latest works of PTA, but I think we can see this kind of emotion through all of his movies. Only his way of expressing them has changed. For example, she mentions one of the final scenes of The Master. Lancaster sings, I would love to get you on a slow boat to China. Nima says, I think the scene is actually a real and powerful romantic gesture and a romantic moment between them. And she also brings up the next scene when Freddie is making love to that woman. He asks her to answer his questions while not blinking, and he tells her, you are the bravest girl I've ever known. In fact, she even says, in my opinion, I think it's even more emotional and sentimental than Hard Eight. Well, thank you, Nima, for writing. We appreciate that.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I mean, I think she brought to my attention a lot of things I hadn't considered in terms of how to read some emotional intensity into those scenes that I might not have otherwise.
Yeah, and I don't want to be misheard on whether or not the level of the passion or the romanticism of Paul Thomas Anderson's work. I agree that I think he's kept that same level of intense emotion. I think the difference probably in the way that he uses it in Hard Eight with the, you know, I love you like a son, he was just a little bit more straightforward about it than he is maybe in later movies. I love that moment, the slow boat to China,
right?
You know, moment in The Master. To me, I think that's a perfect illustration of the same sort of sentiment. It's just it was maybe not quite as direct as, you know, I love you like a son or something like that. But to me, that's part of the evolution, which I think is great.
And I think this is really indicative of what you said in that episode, was that maybe more than any other director, Paul Thomas Anderson invites questions, right? I mean, and he really invites this type of conversation and engagement with his films.
And another listener, the always reliable Nate Dunleavy, had a couple of great points that he made about our Hard Eight episode. He says, one note on Hard Eight that's unlocked a lot for me is it's using the Eden motif. Sidney is God and John is Adam, and that explains the love you like a son line and other things. Jimmy is the serpent and Clementine is Eve. Maybe that's all obvious and on the nose, so that's why you didn't mention it, but structurally, I think it's relevant. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Nate. Yeah, that's exactly why we didn't mention it, because it's just so absolutely obvious totally. To us and everyone else.
Well, I mean, when I read that, and I was like, oh, yeah, totally.
We're screwing around.
I never had that thought.
I'd never heard that in my life. I mean, it's very interesting.
It blew my mind.
Yeah, it's kind of I mean, I guess you could probably poke holes in it, but it's an interesting way to look at that, all those relationships in it.
When he said that, I'm thinking, it made me go back through the movie in terms of my mind and how I was thinking about it, and putting all those different relationships to those characters. Yeah. And it makes you think about the film in a different way. I don't know if I totally buy it as right. If that was PTA's intention, how could we know? I'd still think, nonetheless, it's a fun engagement with the film.
Yeah. Then, of course, it immediately makes you ask questions about, well, what is Paul Thomas Anderson's view then of God?
Right.
If Sidney's the stand-in, you know, what is his view of mankind if, you know, if Clementine and John are the stand-ins for Adam and Eve? And, you know, so it's a lot of questions, but maybe there's questions. It's you know, that's a great That's a great beer time discussion, in my opinion.
It is. My favorite part, though, as you mentioned, is just that I'm sure this is probably obvious. It's so good.
Yes. So open invitation, Nate Dunleavy. Get on a plane and come on out here and reveal more about these movies.
Please.
That were too dense to see.
So good.
Well, nevertheless, thanks again for those who wrote in about our Paul Thomas Anderson episode. And if we didn't mention your comments, no offense meant, but we do appreciate all the comments that you send our way. So thank you.
Yeah, please keep doing that. Yeah.
So what do you say?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Collecting everything we could of theirs, the Lisbon girls wouldn't leave our minds, but they were slipping away. The color of their eyes was fading along with the exact locations of moles and dimples. From 5, they had become 4, and they were all the living and the dead, becoming shadows.
Well, Daniel, I mean, I think that a critic of our podcast could probably credibly look at it and say, I'm noticing patterns in the types of directors that you guys tend to talk about. And so, you know, what's with that?
Yeah, and I guess I'd say to those critics, you're not wrong. I mean,
you're not wrong.
I can't necessarily disagree.
And maybe this is not just an issue with the podcast, but it's something about entertainment in general, is that, yeah, we've been talking about a lot of white guys.
Right.
You know, I think probably the biggest reason for that is because white guys make up 95% of mainstream Hollywood in terms of the directors. Should it be that way? Probably not. But nevertheless, it's about time for a female director.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
And I think that they're out there and they're great. I think one of the things that it brings to mind for me as we're thinking about what films to do, I think I'm just more conscious of the freshman films.
Yeah.
Of white male filmmakers.
Could be. But needless to say, it was time for a female director, and what better candidate than, I think it's safe to call her an accomplished artist in terms of directing, certainly, but not just directing, but in this case, directing. And of course, we're talking about the daughter of Francis Ford Coppola, and that is Sofia Coppola.
Absolutely. And we're doing Sofia Coppola's episode before we've even thought about doing a Francis Ford Coppola episode.
Yeah, now we have spent a little bit of Francis Ford Coppola time, especially in the George Lucas episode. But even as I'm talking, I realize I'm framing this whole thing as it's time to do a girl. Let's pick a girl. That's not it. She's more than worthy, especially if you look at her not incredibly long list of feature films that she's done, but very interesting, in a number of cases, very powerful films. And so I'm excited to talk about Sofia Coppola's freshman film, and of course that is The Virgin Suicides.
1999 film.
Her film was on the list that we mentioned of films that somehow were topped. I don't want to keep doing that. That's ridiculous.
No, we need to name it.
You want to name it?
It was topped by American Beauty.
American Beauty in the Oscar race. You know what? That's the way it went. So, Daniel.
Yes.
1999, which we've talked about as like a fairly watershed year in many ways. When did you first see The Virgin Suicides? And when you saw it, what did you think?
I didn't see The Virgin Suicides until after I'd seen Lost in Translation. So I didn't know this film existed. I watched Lost in Translation, really enjoyed it, was really interested in the style of that film. And so upon kind of learning about Sofia Coppola and her freshman film, The Virgin Suicides, is when I watched it. So it was sometime around the same time. I can't even think of what year that was. What is that, like 2003?
2003.
I hadn't known about The Virgin Suicides until 2003. So I think I can't remember the exact moment or time when I saw it. I just know I saw it after I'd seen Lost in Translation in the theaters.
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah, so I did not see it in the theater. My wife and I rented it, I remember, pretty soon after it came out, available to rent. There was just a lot of buzz about it at the time, and I remember most of the buzz was about Sofia Coppola. She's the real deal. Can you believe it? What, you know, check it out, The Virgin Suicides. I already knew that I liked James Woods.
Right.
So that was a big draw for me. But really, I was just interested to hear what all this talk was about. I remember thinking, this is surprisingly, I mean, I hate to say competent, but that's what I thought. You know, I'm like, this is way better than I thought it was going to be. Because, you know, I was reminded of, I don't know, I'll always remember this interview that I heard once with Julian Lennon, son of John Lennon, you know, who's a fairly successful musician in his own right. And the interviewer, I'll never forget, asked Julian Lennon, so what do you say to all these people who are like, well, of course you've got a music career. Your dad was John Lennon. I mean, you know, And I'll never forget Julian Lennon's response was, yeah, but you know, here's the thing. I've had all these doors open and all these opportunities that yeah, I'm sure other people would kill for in the music industry. But the other side of that is the second I recorded a song, everyone in the world immediately assumed it was going to suck.
Really?
Yeah, which I thought, huh, that's probably, I can see that. Like, everyone is just going to be like, let's hear what the kid has to say. Okay, yeah, right, whatever. What are you going to do? So he's like, yeah, I've had twice the opportunities, but I also have twice as much to prove. So, and I think that same sort of conversation applies to Sofia Coppola, because I remember going into the Virgin Suicide saying, okay, young Coppola, yeah, right. Yeah, what do you have to say? Let's hear what the daughter of the guy who did The Godfather. And surprisingly impactful film. I really enjoyed it.
You did when you saw it. So the first time you saw it.
I did. Now, having watched it again recently in preparation for this, for some reason, I also remember not thinking like I didn't really fully get a lot of it. But having watched it recently, I don't really know what it was I didn't get. Yeah, there is a level of abstraction, but it is fairly straightforward. So, but yeah, I thought not just a competent, but a pretty accomplished film for a first timer.
Yeah. And that's what's interesting. I think I remember seeing it after Lost in Translation. I don't know if I had an idea of what to expect because I had no idea what her first film was like. But I will say, given her style that I saw in Lost in Translation, I was prepared for The Virgin Suicides and really appreciated it. I'm excited to talk about it today because now having watched it more recently, maybe given life experience or whatever,
yeah.
You know, I just have some different thoughts about it than I think I had then. To your point about Sofia Coppola kind of not knowing what she would do or how well she would do it, I mean, she had a pretty checkered past with regard to her acting. I mean, she kind of had a couple strikes against her already, right?
Right. And that's the thing when you like look back at her career, you see a bunch of pretty high profile films that she was in, but more than once kind of cited as the downfall of that film acting wise. And you're like, oh, Sofia.
I know, but I think she found her calling as a filmmaker, as a director.
Clearly.
So.
I mean, it is kind of funny, which I didn't even realize until I was prepping for this a little bit, that she was in The Phantom Menace.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She was, she was one of the handmaidens of Natalie Portman's character.
That's crazy.
With Keira Knightley. So it was like these three ladies who all went on to like, you know, fame and fortune and all this kind of thing. But it's just so interesting. They were walking around like nuns midway through Phantom Menace and, you know, one of these, this despised movie, not just a despised movie, but a despised part of a despised movie. Was just like, what the hell is all this with the, you know, with the queen and they're switching identities. And you know what? I still don't even know
either.
What that's about. But of course, you know, then you also have the Sofia Coppola who's often cited as one of the big downfalls of Godfather 3.
Such a bummer. It's not, I mean, that's true.
Dad? Why are you doing this to me? Why are you, you don't have to do this to me, please.
Doing what?
It's true that it was a bummer, but I don't think any sane person can blame the awfulness of that movie on Sofia Coppola.
Oh, not at all. It's not her fault.
No. I mean, what do you want? Really?
What do you want? So we need to premise this thing.
I can premise it.
Do it.
I haven't premised it in a while. So the premise of the Virgin Suicides, I want to say late 70s.
Yes, I think late 70s is probably accurate.
Late 70s, a family, the Lisbon family, five daughters. And of course, what we learn right from the start is that it's a family where all five of the daughters are going to commit suicide by the end of the movie, which is an interesting way to start a film, is to show your hand right at the start. And so there's this cloud that hangs over the whole thing. Of course, we come to find out that these girls live in a very strict home, particularly because of their mother, as the suicide of the first daughter sort of not just rocks that family's world, but also the community. We're told through the eyes of the boys who are the neighbors, the story of this family, essentially what just went tragically wrong through kind of a broken lens in a way, because it's a, you know, the narrators, because there is more than one, are clearly not completely reliable. In fact, that's a comment that's made partway through the film. So we're kind of left to try and piece together what went wrong in these girls' lives that would make them want to do such an awful thing. They're looked at as the community beauties in a way, which is ironic because their dad is the dopey math teacher of the high school and all that. And so just little by little, bit by bit, we get a taste for this environment and for these girls and for the psychology that may or may not have led to their demise. And in a way, there's a decent amount of ambiguity that we're left with.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that you named it. It's a fascinating thing to suggest that there are multiple narrators. It's the we. And of course, this film was based on a novel of the same name by Jeffrey Eugenides. I haven't read it.
No, I haven't either.
But it's the same idea, and it's narrated by a collection of boys, which already is a fascinating idea.
And we've talked about the idea in the past of the unreliable narrator, or at least we've touched on it. It's such an interesting way to build a movie, particularly given that it's a little bit easier to get away with that kind of ambiguity in something like a novel, because all the pictures and all the relationships are in the minds of the readers, whereas with the movie, by nature, everyone has to be flesh and blood in order to present some kind of coherence to the narrative or some kind of visual experience. But Sofia Coppola does something very, very interesting in that she leaves in as much ambiguity as possible, and she really, the movie is made more in your mind than it is on the screen in many respects. I don't know. Maybe that's overstating.
No, I think that you're right. You can't really draw a line, a clear line, between what is told to you at the beginning of the film. You know what's going to happen. And so immediately you think the film is going to explore, why did this happen?
Yeah.
But it doesn't explore it in the way that you would think it would, or maybe would want it to.
Yeah.
Because you would hope, oh, okay, so man, five sisters within the course of a year commit suicide.
Right.
You want to know what's going to bring them to that. If you don't get clear answers, I mean, you get some maybe pieces of it, right? Strict home, overly religious parents, really stifling their humanity, a loss of innocence and love. Maybe these are some of the reasons, but there's no A plus B equals C. There's just not, it's not there.
Having heard one or two interviews with Sofia Coppola about the topic, she, and maybe this is partly by design, so that we'll experience her movie in the way she would like us to, but she even referenced in an interview once, there is no reason.
Right.
These guys who are now men are having to go over it again and again 20 years later and remember all the pieces that they can to try to understand what happened, only to realize that there's no explanation.
And that's what she wants us to feel. Well, obviously there is a reason or reasons or something like that. But to be able to pin it on something as simple as, oh, well, they were stifled by their mother. Well, yeah. And I think that's actually to her credit, because a lesser filmmaker, that's an easier film to make, put it that way.
For sure. And it's been made.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I've seen that film, right? Like, you blame the parents who are overly religious. I mean, Carrie.
Sure. Yeah, which is a great film.
A great film.
But no, this film leaves you with a lot more questions than Carrie, certainly. And that's what's interesting, too, is you're always trying to also suss out the relationship that the narrators have to the girls. In some cases, there's different groups of boys with maybe limited overlap. You, of course, have the neighbor boys that Right. are obsessed with these girls next door. In fact, they're always all the time looking over with their telescope and all this kind of stuff. Everyone wants to catch a glimpse of the Lisbon girls. They're the boys that are the more popular jock boys that wind up taking the girls to the dance. And, of course, you know, led by the uber hunk Josh Hartnett. And I don't know if you remember, but this was his time.
This was his time, and maybe the best name he's ever been given. Trip Fontaine, right?
Trip Fontaine.
How incredible is that?
I know, man. You're in for an easy ride if your name is Trip Fontaine.
Yeah, you're in for something, that's for sure.
try to understand. He's a magic man, mama.
No, but that was sort of interesting, too, to just hear, and you get moments of Trip as an adult,
yeah,
looking back at his time with the Kirsten Dunst character who plays the daughter, Lux, probably the daughter that we focus on the most.
And I was trying to think about that throughout the film. Why, you know, why her? And in the sense of, like, in terms of where she was in the birth order, and like she's the second to the last child, right? I think she's not the youngest, but the youngest had already committed suicide at the beginning of the film. So you have her as the youngest.
Right.
What makes her who she is in terms of that family, given her place and her role as a daughter, the fourth daughter?
And she clearly is making, I don't know if effort's the right word, but she's making the biggest strides in terms of liberating herself from the psychology of the family. I mean, you know, she's the only girl that we see just unabashedly smoking, drinking, eventually having sex with boys. You can see that she's, effort is the wrong word, but she's making these kind of leaps that fly in the face of everything that her family is about. I guess it makes sense to focus more on her. It is interesting, you're right, that is, especially after her younger sister committed suicide, that she is the youngest, and what's being said there, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know either. coming back to your point about the narrators, these boys, being unreliable, is there a better unreliable narrator than a high school boy?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we have unreliable narrators in the sense of, I've seen them, or I've read stories in which there are unreliable narrators because they're crazy, right? Or because they're out of their minds. No, these are just high school boys.
Right.
Trying to recall what their world was like, mm-hmm. and what these girls were like across the street from them, whom they were in love with. I mean, I just think that, I think about my time as a high school boy, and I go back to that time a lot in my mind, thinking about my family, about school, friends. I'm constantly wondering how much of this is actually true. How much is my experience really what it was like? Were my parents really that stifling and neglectful? Were my friends really that awesome and cool? Were those girls really that beautiful? I mean, I just think that's such a cool, I think that's such a cool element of the film.
There are moments in the film, and I'm thinking specifically about, like, for example, the moment toward the end of the film when the boys are waiting for the girls, and we cut to the shot of them all driving in the open road in the Lisbon family station wagon and all. And you don't realize that that's a fantasy until we cut back to the reality. We're like, oh, okay, I guess that's what happened. I guess they escaped with the girls, and then it cuts back. And there's other moments that are similar in the film where Sofia Coppola doesn't really completely tip her hand about what's the fantasy or what's the ideal or what's the, you know, what's the broken memory and what actually happened. That's part of the ambiguity. But I think she's saying something bigger than just, oh, here's a clever way to make a film. I think in a way she's almost saying something about childhood and adolescence and saying maybe kind of what you're alluding to, where there's this romanticism about our own youth, about the way we remember that time, this coming of age time. Whether it's true or not, maybe isn't the biggest question to ask, but rather, what are we taking from that? How did that contribute to this fantastical time that we all sort of remember through this kind of strange, hazy lens? How does that contribute to the person that we are now?
Absolutely, and how memory, I think, is so elusive and mysterious. I mean, it reminds me, what you were just saying actually reminds me of an interview I recently heard in the past couple of weeks with the author Michael Chabon, who just recently wrote a novel called Moonglow. And it's based a lot on his life, but it's a constant question of what is real, what is fiction, and he's playing with. He wrote the novel to sound like a memoir, and the main character has his name. And so it's just such a fascinating thing. And he was telling this story about a previous short story he wrote about his family divorcing, going to this trip. And he said he took a trip with his brother, like this is a real trip with his brother. And his brother started saying, isn't it crazy when we did this thing? And he starts to describe this short story that Michael wrote. And Michael Chabon said, that never happened.
Right.
I made that up. I don't know, it's such a fascinating thing with memory and I guess the things that kind of embed themselves in our mind because of experiences, because of things that we see, which I think that kind of connects with Sofia Coppola. She's constantly wanting the camera to see things, or she's wanting you to notice things through the camera that you might not otherwise notice. And you think, oh, well, this is just kind of superfluous. Why does this exist?
Right.
Like shots of trees or trees dying and needing to be chopped down or driving. I'm thinking of the different dreamscapes in all of her films and Lost in Translation. Like, how do these things connect? And I think she's trying to get at something through her films that connects to, I don't know, memory, feeling. How do those things play with each other?
You know, I thought a lot about that, and I was thinking about the other films of Sofia Coppola. We're always trying to figure out what are these threads that run through, you know, all the different films. And it occurred to me that if I were to make a documentary about the films of Sofia Coppola, the career of Sofia Coppola, I would probably name it something along the lines of The Filmmaking Poetry of Where.
Right.
Because this is something that's very, very specific to her, is she is intent on place.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's very interesting when you see how almost to the exclusion in some cases of the who and the what in terms of plot, or, you know, place to her is as important, if not more important, than her actual characters. And that's something that's very, very specific to the psychology of, I think, really of all of her films. I mean, you know, her one of her more recent films is even just called Somewhere.
Yeah.
Really, whenever you talk about all of Sofia Coppola's films, you tend to talk about where they took place before you even talk about what happened. Like, I don't know, I look at like Marie Antoinette. It's about Versailles, and it's about Paris, sure. And it's about, you know, it's about all that much more, in my opinion, than it is about the politics of what happened with, you know, Marie herself or any of these characters. Certainly Lost in Translation. People walked away from that movie, many of them saying, I feel like I want to go see Tokyo.
Oh, for sure.
I want to see Japan, and I want to see all these different places that she really, really hits you with that whole idea. And I think the same is true in The Virgin Suicides. Just long, lingering shots with no one in them.
Yeah.
All the time. It's just these are locations and these are places and these are insert setups that just linger on and on and on. And well, I was going to say without any trace of humanity, but that's not true at all. It's you always see the traces. It's the place that tells a story rather than the people in so many cases. And that's fascinating.
That is fascinating because it almost suggests like when she shows those lingering shots and you see all these things throughout her films, it's almost to suggest like things happened here.
Right.
Here's one of the stories that did.
Right.
That's a really great thing to think about. And that thought is helping me, I think more clearly about her films and maybe some of the things that I don't immediately connect with. Or I think with this time with Virgin Suicides, I had a hard time with was I wanted to know more about the people.
Yeah.
But you're shedding some light on maybe that's not necessarily a deficiency, but it's maybe not she's wanting to do something different.
Yeah. Well, and we've talked about this in the past, how when I prep for these films, I like to watch them twice.
Right.
I watch it once just to say, you know, do to me whatever you want to do to me. And then I watch it another time where I'm like, okay, I really want to pick through what I just saw. And I found that in that kind of repeat viewing, I was less concerned about the questions that weren't answered. I was more drawn in by those kinds of elements, that more abstraction, that, you know, that what's like we were talking about, the psychology of memory, the psychology of where, the psychology of the unreliable narrator, all these kinds of things. And I realized that if I had the questions definitively answered that I had, I wouldn't like the movie as much.
Right. Why would you? Because to me, it's all settled. It's done.
Yeah, yeah. And there's nothing settled. There shouldn't be anything settled about The Virgin Suicides.
Yeah. Why should there be a reason
for
five girls committing suicide?
I like the fact that, of course, we mentioned Trip Fontaine. We hear all this narration from the present. You know, of course, we hear Giovanni Ribisi, who is clearly one of the boys. Do we ever really totally know which boy Giovanni Ribisi was supposed to be?
No. I assumed that it was the...
Parky?
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what's implied. And maybe the book sheds light on this. I honestly don't know. But you never quite really hone in on it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we hear narration from Trip Fontaine, but he's the only one that we actually get to see in the present day.
And know that it's him.
And, you know, he but it's interesting, you know, there's a moment that's clearly not a throwaway where, you know, he gets to the end of talking about it and someone walks in and said, you know, it's time for your 6 o'clock group meeting. We can see that he's had to battle some sort of demons in his life or something like that. Is the implication that these demons manifested because of what his relationship was with Lux or something like that? Now, that might be an overread, but at the same time, we still have to sit in that. And we have to figure out, okay, well, this story and that story have something to do with each other, even if it's this really, really tenuous relationship. And that's one of the examples of a moment where I'm like, I'm glad I don't know, you know? I think that adds gravity to the story that I don't know what went down with Trip Fontaine.
So here's a question then that I've been dying to ask you this question, or at least talk about it, because I have no damn idea what's going on here. But so there's a moment after Trip takes Lux to the dance. I think it's homecoming, right? They both win homecoming king and queen, and they're underneath the stage and drinking and making out. Then they go to the field. They have sex, and the morning comes, and Trip Fontaine leaves, or maybe in the middle of the night he leaves. But no matter, Lux is sleeping, and she doesn't know.
Right.
Why? It's such an important moment, and it seems in the way that Sophia directs it and tells the story, there's a connection to be made in terms of that moment, not necessarily where Trip finds himself later on in the narration, but the demons he's battling. Right. Something happened there, because he's constantly saying, I loved her. You know, right. I didn't feel a love like that. You maybe only feel that once. I mean, he's saying these things.
Yeah.
So why did he leave her?
This is a great question. I don't know. And I thought about the same thing. To me, it ties a little bit back to the, there's a comment made earlier in the film when they talked about how all the guys that had been with Lux all had stories, or at least claimed to have been with Lux, all had stories about how that went and, you know, okay, what it was like and all that.
The boys who talked with Lux were always the stupidest boys and made terrible sources of information.
You want to know what happened? Smell my fingers, man.
Nah, she didn't talk about Cecilia. We weren't exactly talking, if you know what I mean.
But the only reliable boy who actually got to know Lux was Trip Fontaine.
And then, you know, we get into the Trip Fontaine story. And then and we even hear Trip Fontaine later in his life talking about, you know, his relationship with Lux. And the reason I find that interesting is because the more we hear from Trip Fontaine, the less reliable he seems personally to me.
Totally.
I can tell you how I take it. Now, this isn't the interpretation, but I think it's clear, depending on what your definition of love is, did Trip Fontaine love Lux? Not at all.
Right.
I don't think. Right. You know, I think, sure, she was this picture of this kind of obsession that he may have had at one point, and the dramatic quality of not just their relationship and but also her end, and, you know, all this kind of stuff, which I'm sure made an impact of some kind in his life. But all that kind of adds up to this idea that, you know, and even when you see Trip Fontaine talking to his dads,
yeah,
it just seems like Trip Fontaine has been able to get away with this situation in his life where he's never really had to want. And that was the thing that she gave him, you know, is this
the desire.
Yeah, this wanting. Maybe there's a side of it where that was what he loved, was he loved that he got to experience that. And she was the only one that gave him that, I guess, in a way. And quite frankly, once that hill had been conquered, I think he knew that he would never get back to that place again.
Huh.
I think that he was more content to leave it in that place. Now, you know, I don't know, you could probably poke holes in that, but I think that he knew it would never be better than it was in that night, and so he had to leave it alone.
I walked home alone that night. I didn't care how she got home. It was weird. I mean, I liked her. I liked her a lot. But out there on the field, it was just different then. That was the last time I saw her.
No, I like that. It makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, one of the things I kept thinking about with regard to that moment, I guess the film as a whole, and then Sofia Coppola's work in general, is that she's constantly exploring characters who want something, and they don't necessarily know what it is.
Yeah.
But there's a searching. There's a looking for it. Yeah, I don't know if that's Trip, like searching, looking for it. Certainly, I can see that in Lux, wanting something different, again, not knowing what it is. I can see that in Lost in Translation, Marie Antoinette.
Sure. Somewhere.
Somewhere. And what's fascinating, too, and this is not true of the Virgin Suicides, but I think it's true of Trip. They're people of privilege looking for something. Like, you think that they could actually have whatever it is they wanted at any moment.
Right.
And yet, they're still dissatisfied. And I can see that in him, and she kind of carries that through to her other films. I'm not trying to simplify it. I think it's more complicated than that, but I'm just trying to make connections to,
sure, yeah,
to the stories that she's telling.
Because, you know, ultimately, this is a discussion about Sofia Coppola and and that's a thread we can see. We can see that in Bill Murray in Lost in Translation. We can see that in Kirsten Dunst and Marie Antoinette. On and on, you can see that, right, kind of vibe. A person of privilege who's searching for meaning in, yeah, a way. You know, I mean, that's a common thread. You probably don't need to be Sigmund Freud to see why Sofia Coppola might be a kind of person to reuse that. I don't know. Are there other things you think that Sofia Coppola carries through to her other films that maybe we see, maybe we do, maybe we don't see in Virgin Suicides?
There are a few filmmakers that make it clear for me how I'm supposed to feel about this.
Yeah.
And not in a way that's actually manipulative. I actually think she does a great job of not telling me how I should feel and how I need to do the job of getting there. Mm-hmm. It's through her filmmaking style and her stories that I just feel that. And like, I feel this sense of meandering, of desire, of wanting, of, I mean, almost like this floating space. I mean, it's a really fascinating thing. So that, I notice certainly her use of music.
Music is, I was actually going to bring that up. I mean, it's that's something that I, every time I watch a Sofia Coppola movie, I immediately go onto Amazon to check out the soundtrack, because it's a, she has this remarkable talent for picking really specific, and I'll just say it, really great songs for all of her films.
So good. I mean, Air, right? To yeah. Doing the music for the Virgin Suicides. That's a thing about her. I couldn't imagine different music in her films, or music I'd like to hear more than the music I'm already hearing.
Right.
And I think this might be a criticism for some about Marie Antoinette. It's not my criticism of that film, the music.
Right.
Because I think that the music supports what she's trying to do so well.
Yeah.
In that film in particular, maybe the best in terms, because it seems such a there's a dissonance between the music you hear and what you're seeing, or at least the time period in which the film is depicted. Yeah, I think that's great. She uses music so, so well in such a helpful way.
And I remember it was never more pointed than when she did Marie Antoinette, the criticism of, well, what are you doing? I mean, you've got this period piece and all this kind of stuff, and all of a sudden, what is the Jesus and Mary chain
right.
in the 18th century or something? I mean, what is that? I don't know, though. I feel like, you know, I go back to Baz Luhrmann with Romeo and Juliet or something like that. It's like, well, okay, maybe hold on, though. Let her do what she's going to do here. Because, yeah, I mean, you could say that doesn't jive with what's in my brain. Sofia Coppola, you know, of any director, is one who's saying, try changing what's in your brain for a second then, you know? I mean, just give this a shot. This is kind of bridges into another thing that I think is common in her films, is she has such a specific sense of pace.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up.
I think that when you sit down with a Sofia Coppola film, you come with certain expectations, as you do with any film, but she doesn't really care about respecting your expectations. She more cares about the place, the narrative, the questions that she wants you to ask. And I think that's really, really important. Even sitting down with Virgin Suicides, because, you know, we live in a culture where we're used to this certain thing in film language. We're used to movies that are paced in a certain way.
Right.
Call it the ADD culture that we live in or something like that. But it's actually a big deal to watch a movie that's paced very, I'll just say slowly and deliberately. Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes a director like, you know, Nicholas Refn such an outstanding outlier, you know.
Right.
Because he even takes it even farther than Sofia Coppola and just says, you know, no, if you think that your own internal sense of pace is what's going to drive the decisions I make as an editor, you're out of your mind. This is going to go as slow as I need it to go. And that's how Virgin Suicides, that's how Lost in Translation, that's how every single one of her films is, where she says, No. You have to leave your life behind if you want to enter into this, because this is going to take a little while, and the story I'm going to tell is going to be told in a certain way. I think of the opening of the film Somewhere.
Oh, I was going to bring that up.
You know, yeah, it was so interesting. So she just, I mean, I feel like the first, what is it, 3 minutes plus?
I think it's more. I mean, I can't even believe how long it is.
You're just looking at nothing. I mean, nothing. You're looking at nothing. You're staring at the side of what looks like a private kind of, what, like racetrack
or
something?
That's what it seemed. I mean, you don't even know it's a racetrack until the car comes back around the first time, right?
Yeah, and it just goes on for minutes and minutes and minutes, and you're listening to a car go down a racetrack. Every so often you see it pass, but in a way, that's her signal to you that says, leave anything that you think you want to bring into this behind, because this is my show.
Right.
And if it takes me 3, 4, 5 minutes of you staring at an empty racetrack to get you to realize that, then that's what I'm going to have to do. And yeah, I mean, that can get annoying, but it's also, I don't know, I respect the hell out of it.
Oh, me too. And I think I'm just thinking specifically of that moment. You're just sure when it should be done.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay, I get it. He's going around this track. You just imagine, oh.
One more lap and maybe
right,
that's it.
For sure. And it would just keep going. And I've thought about that moment, and it's almost to suggest, like, at least for his character, yes, he should have been done.
Right.
He should have only needed one or two rounds around that track.
Right.
But he doesn't know when enough is enough.
Yeah.
He kind of takes things a little bit further than they probably should be taken, to the detriment of himself or so many other things, to the detriment of the viewers, even. Yeah, she does that in her films where she goes into a scene, and then you think that she would have left the scene because you have all the information you probably need. A good moment for that in The Virgin Suicides is when Kathleen Turner's character is telling Lux after coming home from church that she needs to burn her records. That scene on the stairs before they actually burn the records, and even when they're burning them and then there's a smoke, that sequence takes a long time.
That's not fair!
I said now.
You have everything you need to know, and then it just continues to go, and you see the smoke and all, and people coughing, and you're like, okay, wow, you know.
Yeah,
just to suggest, like, no, I'm doing something, I know what I'm doing, it's not because I'm careless,
right?
And so you're forced as a viewer to ask the questions that maybe she's wanting you to ask, or at least to sit in that longer than you'd like to.
While we're on the subject of questions, I want to ask you a question. The gas masks, the green mist.
The David Lynch sequence of
the
film?
Yeah, this thing where we've told the story, we've got to the climax, and then she gives us 5 extra minutes of this strange sort of aftermath that has to have something to do with the rest of the movie, but I want to know what you think that is.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck by that scene, and I was thinking about the boys being there. I mean, the only thing I can think of, so I know that it's taking place somewhere in Detroit. You get glimpses of something happening. I don't know if it's, what is it, ecologically?
They made reference to something about there was a spill at the plant or something.
Okay, so you have these things, and I thought one of the things that was happening, you have these boys being there, you have this family, this party, people who are in a place in life to parody something serious.
Right.
So you have this thing maybe going on outside of this house and the larger society, or at least their neighboring communities of what's going on. And so then they decide to then have a party that's, right. I don't know if it's poking fun or just kind of, just like this microcosm of maybe what other people are experiencing, but they're not. In some ways, that is what's happening with every other family except for the Lisbon family.
Right.
I mean, you have this tragedy that's happened, and no other families experience the amount of tragedy that this one family has.
Right.
And yet you have these other people who are able to go on with life as normal.
Yeah.
You can't imagine that that's possible.
Right.
For the Lisbon family. I don't know how I feel about it, actually. You don't experience the grief of the family, of the parents.
Right.
And so I sometimes feel like their humanity is like given really short shrift in terms of the story. Like,
yeah.
And because of that. But if the story is told through the eyes of high school boys,
right,
then they have no concept necessarily at that point in their lives of grief, or at least it can be assumed that maybe they don't to the extent that these parents have experienced it. But neither can any of the other families in that community.
Right.
They haven't been able to experience what this family's experienced, so life can go on as normal. They can start to parody things that are deathly serious for others and make a party out of it. I mean, I don't know. That's my reach in terms of...
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe they have to. I mean, maybe that's what that is. With a father and a mother, however good a father and a mother they may be, when you lose 5 daughters in 1 year at their own hand, there's not a word invented for that grief.
Right.
In a way, I think that's a stink that fills the town, you know? The narrator even mentions the adults kind of moved on like, well, that's something that happens, you know? And the kids just didn't know what to think about it. And I think, maybe that was an embodiment of that situation where, you know, you see this party where the theme was asphyxiation, which, by the way, was the method of 2 of the girls' death. You see people walking around in gilded gas masks and drinking this green liquid. Maybe that's what they have to do. You know, in a way, there's a stink that's filled our town. Really, all we can do is just dress up our gas masks as well as we can and just keep drinking, because that's what life is, isn't it? We certainly can't put ourselves in the position of the Lisbons. That's death. That's suicide.
Yeah.
And so this is who we are. Maybe that's something. I don't know. But I like the fact that Coppola is asking us to ask those questions.
I know, because you can't just assume, oh, that it just looks cool or weird or interesting, so we're going to throw it in. I mean, given the what leads up to that moment, you have to be able to ask of that scene how it connects to the rest of the film.
Yeah. So, Sofia Coppola, five feature films,
right,
since 1999. What do you think? Where does the Virgin Suicides fit in her body of work?
Okay, so I've not seen The Bling Ring, so I want to be upfront about that.
Yeah, that makes two of us.
So having not seen that film, I'd actually place The Virgin Suicides probably third, after Lost in Translation and Somewhere. I actually really like that film.
Oh, okay.
And then The Virgin Suicides, and I think, well, it's tough with Marie Antoinette because there are so many things about that film. If we were talking about that film in this podcast, you would know that I actually love that film for so many reasons. Mm. But the reasons why I love The Virgin Suicides, I think, makes it a little bit, in my mind, a higher pick than Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So what about you?
Yeah, so like you, I've not seen The Bling Ring. Interested to see it. It's just not something that I've gotten to. This is a tough one. You know, I don't know. Similar to Paul Thomas Anderson, it's just the quality of these movies is just doesn't, for me anyways, lend itself to ranking very well, because I feel like, I don't know, based on what, even if I'm trying to figure out which one I like the most.
I
like,
know,
even
I know.
Just that baseline thing, I don't know.
You just asked me to do it, and then you dismiss what I just did. Which, I mean, I get it. You know what, Daniel, go for it. All right, you're wrong, can't be done, so...
Well, I'm saying this is my struggle. That's what I'm saying. We still have to have some sort of opinion, because why else are we doing this? I mean, you know, people listening to this podcast have to know. They got to go on with their day somehow.
They need to know where you land.
Where I land on Sofia Coppola. Marie Antoinette, I think, is my favorite film of hers.
Okay.
Honestly, I'll go out on a limb and say that. Maybe there's a contrarian spirit behind that, because I know that it's probably, critically anyway, it was maybe considered the least of her films. I know they kind of dogged on Somewhere to a degree too, but people felt very let down by Marie Antoinette, particularly as the follow-up to Lost in Translation, which
and
was
I think that's
a celebrated
important
thing. Yeah. I loved Marie Antoinette. I loved everything about it. I loved the fact that, well, you know, a little straighter maybe than a lot of her films, but I think it still has that quality of, no, we got to ask the questions now. Like, what is she getting at? What is she doing? Like, why is she doing that? The lingering quality, you know. Conversely, I was not as impressed as everyone else in the world by Lost in Translation.
Okay.
I'm going to say very much liked the film. It would be overstating to say that I loved it, but I really, really liked it. That being said, Somewhere, I still don't quite know what to do with. Mm-hmm. I don't know where to put that. But I will say that I think Virgin Suicides, I would put in between Marie Antoinette and Lost in Translation. As in, I liked it better than Lost in Translation. Maybe not quite as much as I liked Marie Antoinette. The art direction of Marie Antoinette was so intensely awesome.
So good.
I can't. That, to me, that maybe won me over more than anything else. I couldn't stop. I hated the fact that I had to blink during the film because, you know, it was like, oh, that's one frame of film that I don't get to see, because everything was so gorgeous in that movie. It was just so perfectly right. The fact that it was shot at Versailles, a lot of it, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Just amazing. An amazing achievement. The fact that Sofia Coppola was doing something that specific, a point of view about something that's that big and expensive and, you know, beautiful. I mean, just that's the definition of going out on a limb. So anyway, I don't want to talk it to death, but the repeat viewing of Virgin Suicide has shot it way up on my list. I'll be honest, I liked Virgin Suicides before going into this latest round of watching it. I love it now.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think it's an incredible, incredible achievement. I'm so glad that we did this episode, because I got to return to a film that I didn't realize was this good.
And I don't think we've talked about it enough, that Francis Ford Coppola's daughter decided to make this film as her first film. And I think that's part of the criticism against her. She could have made anything she wanted.
Yeah.
She literally, I think, could have made anything she wanted. And this is the story she chose to tell, and in this way. And I think that is a beautiful picture of, I don't know, of confidence, of courage, of something.
Yeah.
And I think the same should be said of making Marie Antoinette after making something like Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
That, I think, doesn't get enough play, because that is such a brave choice.
Really, really brave. And I think that she saw that if she was ever going to make that movie, that was the time to make it, because she had never been hotter, you know?
Right.
Her star couldn't have been more quickly on the rise. And she said, look, if I'm going to ask for the big bucks that I need to do something like this, it's going to have to be now. And she did it. And good on her for that. Also important to note that Virgin Suicides was, of course, an American Zoetrope production.
Right.
Francis Ford Coppola wholly made that happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, say what you will, but that's, it wouldn't have happened if Francis Ford Coppola hadn't been her dad. But that's great. I don't know. I mean, you could compare the two's career. I don't know how helpful that is to right. compare their careers. I mean, we've talked about it in the past. Francis Ford Coppola, he seems to be on a downtrend. I haven't seen some of his latest stuff, so I can't say if that's completely true. But she clearly knows her own mind. She's going to do what she's going to do. I was actually very fascinated by the Christmas special that she directed.
See, I haven't seen that yet either.
It's one of those things. Okay, well, here's a quality to Sofia Coppola. The first viewing of any Sofia Coppola movie, I don't really think is going to get the job done.
That's fair.
And that even applies to the Bill Murray Christmas special on Netflix. I mean, it's such an interesting thing. I watched it and I was like, okay, not sure what to think about that. Returned to it again this past Christmas season. And I was like, wow, that's actually, it's funny, but it's not funny. It's right. just kind of funny, but it's more just like, you know, it's like watching a dream or something. It's just, it's very, very odd. But I found that I was really enamored by the whole production. I don't know why, you know, but anyway, it's just, she makes her audience operate on her terms. And that's what I appreciate.
That is, yeah, I think that's well said.
So Virgin Suicides, does the film stand on its own, or would you call it a completist film?
Those who are listening should watch it. I think absolutely.
Yeah.
I think people should watch it. And I think it's an important film to watch now, given what you said about how we've been trained to watch things.
Right.
This is a movie, like some of my favorite novels, my other favorite films, it teaches you how to watch it. And, yeah. and you kind of need to submit yourself to how it's being told if you're going to get something from it or enjoy it.
I agree. I love the film. I think, no, there's nothing completist about it. This is a movie, I think particularly if you saw it closer to the time that it came out, watch it again. We're in 2017 now, so that's 17, 18 years since this film first came out, and it deserves another look. It operates on that level. It deserves to be looked at and discussed. And that's... That sounded like I said in disgust. No, it deserves to be looked at and discussed. Watch it with someone that you care about in your life and talk about it. If you have children, if you have
yeah.
a family that maybe you don't even live close to or something like that, it's something that really causes you to grapple with what is family? What is my place in the community? What's going on at my neighbor's house that would blow my mind if I really knew about it? Is that worth asking them about? Is it worth investigating? And I don't mean like in a suspicious sense, but in the how involved are we in the right ways with our community? I haven't read the novel. I'm sure it explores a lot of that, but yeah, absolutely. Go take another look at The Virgin Suicides. I think you'll be happy you did.
Absolutely.
Well, great film. I think that's it for this episode of The Freshman 15. Thank you for joining us. Daniel and I are saying Virgin Suicides, A-OK. Check it out. Thoughtful movie. Don't expect light fare, but by all means, take a look at it. And if you do, please write in and tell us what you think.
And if you want to reach us to tell us what you think of this episode or of the podcast in general, you can find us on Facebook or Instagram, or you can email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. And a quick favor, if you have a moment to go onto iTunes and to give us a rating, that's really helpful. And when people search for the podcast, it makes it easy to find. And we've really appreciated those who have taken the time to rate us and to put reviews on there. Greatly appreciate that.
Yes. Thank you for those who have rated. But yeah, please take a moment if you wouldn't mind to do that. And of course, we couldn't end things without mentioning our friends at Steelcraft. Born of a desire to see people come together over food and drinks, Steelcraft unites local eateries with a communal dining space in Long Beach. Whether you come for the food, the drinks, or the people, there's a place for you at the Steelcraft table. For more information, visit steelcraftlb.com.
And I can speak from experience. That place is awesome.
You know what? I think that this is maybe our first episode that we've recorded that Steelcraft has actually been open.
It's going. It's there. You have Steelhead Coffee there. You have Smog City Brewing. You have Desano Pizza, Waffle Love Waffles. I mean,
more places opening up even as we're talking, I
absolutely.
Think.
Absolutely. So Steelcraft. Check it out. It really is worth going to. Thanks again for listening. I'm Daniel Long.
And I'm Jeremy Bear. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.